Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and do not adjust your AirPods, or if you're old-fashioned like me, the headphones that still have the strings attached to them. I am talking through my nose a little bit. It's the most wonderful time of year in Florida, where it's 83 one day and 53 the next, and 83 the day after that. And in that brief period of time where it is 83 degrees, all the trees just release their pollen. Your kids get snotty. They share that snottiness with you. And basically, Florida turns into one giant peninsula of phlegm. And it's that should actually be our tourism pitch here. Come to the Sunshine State, one big peninsula of phlegm. So bear with me as I do talk through my nose on this particular podcast. But what crammed snot up my sinus cavity lacks, what we do make up for it, however, is the topic of this episode. And it is one of my favorites. And I have to give the credit to my friend Coach Mike McLaughlin, who suggested this. We were just texting back and forth, I want to say maybe about a month ago, just about various things. And he made the suggestion for this show, and I said, that's a great idea. Let me figure out how I'm going to tackle it, because there are a lot of cards that fall into this particular category. And the best way that I think I could attack it is, I gave it away. If you follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stands, I gave it away with promoting the show, saying, here's what we're going to be talking about this week. But also, if you watched the video link that we posted at YouTube yesterday, you heard me reference it a few times. And it all starts way back. We're talking almost 25 years ago. So when I was in my teens, I was a huge David Letterman fan. And I caught Letterman at the end of his time at NBC. So 91, 92, 93, around there. And when Letterman went to CBS, that much ballyhooed transition of late night host, and Letterman went up against Jay Leno and The Tonight Show, I naturally followed Letterman over to CBS. I would watch his show religiously every weeknight at 11:30 Eastern Time, 10:30 Central. And I enjoyed it. And because I was such a disciple of David Letterman, I guess this is human nature, I don't know. I just did not want to give the time of day to the guy who was following in his footsteps at NBC, Conan O'Brien. And it wasn't until I got into college and living in a central time zone where national network television programming comes on an hour earlier than what I was used to in the Eastern time zone, I was able to stay up late and watch Conan O'Brien, which was on at 11:30 local time in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And when I was in my freshman year in college, I really started liking Conan's show. And it was strange how all of a sudden my hero, David Letterman, at this exact same time seemed to be just a cranky old man. And of course, part of it was he was, losing in the ratings battle with Leno. He had also, CBS was taking a dive in the ratings. Letterman at this point in time had been in the talk show sphere for a good 15, 20 years, and he was just, getting into a rut. And I remember one of the earliest bits that I saw on Conan's show, and it wasn't really a bit. It was just one of those kind of sight gags, just one of those running jokes. And that's always been a thing with me and humor is, the running gag is always a fun thing if you do it right and you're subtle with it sometimes. I don't know where they got this, but somehow they found a cardboard cutout, a life-size cardboard cutout of Andrew Ridgely, or as they referred to him throughout the night on the program, the other guy from Wham. So keep in mind, this is like 1992, six, I want to say, you know, 80s pop music was still very passe. You know, now, you know, 80s stuff, retro, it's all the rage, and people actually listen to, you know, some of the awful music and enjoy it, and they think back of the fashion trends, and, you know, New Coke briefly made a comeback. So it's kind of weird how nostalgia brings back some of the worst of these times. But especially in the mid-1990s, when you're still in the grunge phase, or maybe your pop music choices have changed. You know, this is, you know, Backstreet Boys and NSYNC are just starting to start up, and you got the Macarena going on. You're like, you know, 80s music, that's terrible. you're saying this while you're dancing to the Macarena, go figure. Anyways, you know, looking back at 80s pop music, people used to laugh in the mid-90s. So to have this large life-size cardboard cutout of quote-unquote the other guy from Wham standing in with Max Weinberg and the Max Weinberg 7, which at that time was the house band for Conan, it was a great running gag, because whenever the show went flat, be it, you know, some of the prepared jokes for Conan, or maybe the guest wasn't quite hitting on all cylinders, they could always just go to a shot of this cardboard cutout of Andrew Ridgely and have a cheap laugh. And don't feel bad for Andrew Ridgely, by the way. And I mentioned this in the video link, which, by the way, is called the Wax Ecstatic Andrew Ridgely Cards. Don't feel bad for Andrew Ridgely, because even though his cohort in the band Wham, George Michael, went on to much more fame and fortune as not only a member of Wham, but as a solo artist, as a rather flamboyant representative of the LGBTQ community up until his passing a few years ago, Andrew Ridgely can afford to laugh at the notion that he's the other guy from Wham, because he wrote the song Careless Whisper, and he is still collecting the royalty checks 35 years later. So every time you're listening to your adult classic hits station and George Michael as a solo artist comes on and starts singing Careless Whisper, it's Andrew Ridgely laughing all the way to the bank. So laugh at his cardboard cutout all you want, but Andrew Ridgely is doing just fine from what I saw. So with that sight gag in mind, and, you know, I've always kind of, ever since I saw that episode of Late Night with Conan O'Brien, I've always, whenever paired up or seeing something where somebody is paired up with somebody else, or something is paired up with something else, and one of those two is far more successful than the other, I've often referred to as the lesser known of the two as the Andrew Ridgely of the group, or, you know, the other guy from Wham, you know, of the pairing, or a trio as the case may be. So going back to just a few weeks ago, Coach Mike says, hey, you should do a show about the multiplayer rookie cards, where there's one, you know, Hall of Famer, and then there's one nobody on the other. I said, that's a great idea. And I decided to take it from the Andrew Ridgely approach here for a couple of reasons. One, it's just a great gag when you see, you know, a very famous name on one part of the card and a not so famous name on the other. And you'll also learn that some of the not so famous names, or those who are in the shadow of the famous players, much as we've learned on this program for the last few years, the common player is not necessarily a common person. There's very interesting stories with all of these players. And you'll also see, as we'll discuss, some of these multiplayer rookie cards actually turned out to have an incredible collection of players. And the best example I can think of off the top of my head is the 1968 Nolan Ryan card, which is often referred to as one of those quote-unquote Andrew Ridgely cards. That's not the case. Sure, you have Hall of Famer Nolan Ryan, but he's paired with Jerry Kuzman, who was one of the most dominant, consistent left-handed pitchers for the Mets and throughout his entire career. which went, if memory serves correct, into the late 70s. So it's not like Jerry Koosman was just kind of this borderline minor leaguer who bounced around here and there. He actually had a very good career. Was it Nolan Ryan-esque? No. But the funny thing is, if you look back at the history and the scouting reports of Nolan Ryan in 1968, if you had to put $100 on which of those two would have the longer, more fruitful career in Major League Baseball, I would bet 95% of the people challenged with that bet would put their money on Jerry Koosman, because Nolan Ryan was very erratic, had very little playing time because he had National Guard duties at the time, was dealing with blisters on his fingers at the time, and as it would turn out, his style of pitching was actually more crafted towards the American League and the different type of strike zone, and of course the designated hitter in 1973 coming around. So Nolan Ryan excelled with the Angels after that trade with the Mets following the 1971 season. So, you know, that's a great example of a multiplayer card where actually everybody involved was pretty good. Another example I can think of, and we mentioned this in the video, 1978 Topps catcher's card featuring Dale Murphy, Lance Parrish, Ernie Witt, and Bo Diaz. Now, Dale Murphy would become a center fielder because all of his throws to second on steal attempts as a catcher ended up in the outfield, so the Braves didn't want any of that. They decided to use that arm going in the other direction. They're like, hey, if you're going to throw the ball 300 feet, you might as well at least be getting it into, you know, home plate or the cutoff man. But you had Dale Murphy, borderline Hall of Famer, and I think now with, you know, some of the players that are getting introduced or getting close to induction in the Hall of Fame, I think a discussion, of course, this would have to be a veteran committee move, but a discussion of having Dale Murphy in the Hall is going to start heating up over the next few years. But you also have Lance Parrish, who was a rock behind the plate for the Tigers for much of the 80s. You have Ernie Witt, who certainly didn't have Hall of Fame numbers, but he was a consistent presence behind the plate in Toronto for a good 10 or 11 years as well. A very similar track to Parrish's time in Detroit. And then you had Bo Diaz, and we've talked about him before. You know, Diaz was not necessarily a top catcher, but he was certainly good at what he did to where he played about 15 years in the big leagues. And if he wasn't a starter in, say, Cleveland, he was a very ample backup in Boston and Cincinnati and other stops along the way. So that is an example of the multiplayer rookie cards where things went extremely well for most everyone on the cards. But most of the cards that have come out, as we will discuss, they didn't quite have that fairness ratio to the two, three, or four players who were on that card. Now, when it comes to player stories, if I went through the history of these cards, which extends from 1962 to 82, and then it came back in 92, the mid-90s, actually, and this was all the doing of Topps, although Fleer would pick up on the notion of multiplayer rookie cards in the 1980s as well. But if I went through all of the cards that kind of fit into the Andrew Ridgely classification, this show would run 3 hours. So I'm not, you know, I have enough issues talking today, specifically through my nose, but, you know, we're not going to devote that much time to it. But what we will do is we'll have some of the in-depth stories of some of the players on the cards that were featured in the video that was posted yesterday. And in short, the stars of those cards include Carlton Fisk, his 72 Topps card, Frank White, 74 Topps card, Gary Carter, 75 Topps, Andre Dawson, 77 Topps, and Steve Henderson of 82 Topps. So we'll talk about some of the other players that were associated with those rookie cards, and sticking to, you know, the whole creation behind the show, these are cards in my own personal collection here. So one that I left out totally by accident was Craig Nettles. I actually picked it up at the local card show a couple weekends ago. Craig Nettles is paired with Danny Morris, 69 Topps card. Danny Morris pitched in a handful of games for the Twins in 1968 and 69, and Nettles, of course, first with the Twins, later with the Indians, and most notably with the Yankees. An outstanding career. He played for a couple other teams too, but a big piece of the Bronx Zoo Yankees of the 1970s and early 80s. So that's one that kind of got left off the table when I was talking about those cards in the video. But what we'll do is we'll focus on four or five of the players, the Andrew Ridgelys, if you will, from those cards. But what we'll do is the cards from 1962 up until 71. I'll go through some of the more notable ones. And then I'll leave it up to you. You can go combing through the 1970s because there are less of the big stars that share those rookie cards. Topps was able to figure out who some of the big star players, such as the George Bretts and the Robin Younts and the Ricky Hendersons, would be that they didn't put them on the multiplayer cards. But as I mentioned with the 78 Topps catchers cards, also, Paul Molitor, his rookie card as well, sharing it with Alan Trammell, the Jack Morris rookie card. There are some rookie cards from 77, 78, the multiplayer cards that do have two or three decent players on there. And it's fun if you can even just Google the images. Just type in like 1975 Topps rookies and you'll see some of those multiplayer cards and you can pick out the ones that stand out. So that's how we're going to approach it. We'll talk a little bit about just the whole idea behind multiplayer rookie cards. Why did they do it? There's really no official explanation, but I do have a pretty good educated guess as to why it started, why it ended, and why it came back in the early 90s. And again, we'll talk about those particular cards we discussed in the video, a few of the players that are on them, and we'll have a lot of fun doing it. But before we carry on with today's show, I just want to remind you that Wax Ecstatic comes your way every 2 weeks. Noon Eastern on Fridays is when we drop it, so the next show will be coming on Valentine's Day. That is my gift to you. That's all I got. I've got a podcast about baseball cards. It's the best I can do for you. That's my love for you for listening. But that'll be coming out Friday, February 14th at noon Eastern via our main channel, our home plate, if you will, Audio Boom, but it's also transmitted via our RSS to numerous outlets, including Apple Podcast, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Spotify, Google Play, Chromecast. It's everywhere. So make sure you tell a friend about it. Tell them to bookmark it. Latch on to that RSS and subscribe to the program as well. And I'd also want to remind you that if you are using a platform such as Apple Podcast, which allows you to rate and review the show, please do. Please be honest too. If there's something that we could be doing better, just, let it all air out. But give it 4 or 5 stars, whatever the max is, if you feel we're doing a good job. And talk it up, because every positive review helps bump the show up into the algorithm. So people who are listening to podcasts about sports, about baseball, about the 1980s, about baseball cards in general, as they're listening to one podcast, and again, Apple Podcasts is the best example I can think of, you'll see you might be interested in, and it'll list 3 or 4 other podcasts. The more reviews, the more suggestions that we get from listeners to other people to tune into this podcast, it helps bump up our show in the algorithm that sets up that you might want to listen to list. So thank you to everybody who has rated and reviewed the show. We appreciate it. And of course, the best way to get people to listen is to tell us or tell your friends about us. And one easy way to do that is to just tag them on Twitter. Our Twitter timeline is at Wax and Gum Stains. Just write us in, tell people, hey, you should be listening to this show. Word of mouth does a wonderful promotion, especially with this particular hobby, too. We're a very niche group of people here. And if somebody says, you got to listen to this show, chances are a strong hobbyist, a big believer in some of the older cards, even if it is junk wax, will gladly listen. Now, we've had a lot of fun conversations on the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline over the last couple of weeks since our last show. I know a lot of people in general were not thrilled about the topic of our last program, which was 89 Tops. And I approached it as, you know, revisiting not just a junk wax set, but a bargain bin beauty as well. And for me, it's always special because that was the first set that I collected. So, you know, I think there was a consensus of, you know, it's an okay set, but there's no Ken Griffey Jr. rookie, so I'm not going to break into any packs. And hey, that, as I mentioned in the show, that's one reason why some people have shied away from it over the years. And it's also another reason why it's extremely affordable if you want to pick up a bunch of packs or even a wax box like I did. I got mine off the bargain table. It was like $6 or something like that. And it's just a fun couple of hours of ripping open packs and looking through cards. And as I'm hand collating, you know, I'm doing this with a lot of the junk wax era sets. I'm trying to piece together my 89 top set. It's fun opening up the packs, seeing all the stars, seeing the stars whose cards are completely ruined by 30-year-old gum stains, and also pulling out those individual cards and plugging them into the open spaces in the box and getting a little closer to finishing off that set, which, of course, I will sell for top dollar. Or I will just keep in my closet with all the other baseball cards. But definitely one of the two. Now, some of the conversation, too, was around the Wax Pack book. And we had Topps Pursuit write us and say, it would break format, but I'd love to hear a Wax and Gum Stains, a Wax Ecstatic episode around Wax Pack book when it comes out. Now, Wax Pack book, it's a book that is written about a random 1986 Topps pack. And the author of the book went out to track down all of the players, at least those who are still alive, and basically just catch up with them, see what was going on in their lives ever since this pack of cards came out. Now, here's the thing, Topps Pursuit, and I mentioned this in Twitter, but I said we were well ahead of the curve because when this podcast started, this was back in the summer of 2016, I actually connected up with the Wax Pack author, as well as the people running the social media channel, and said, hey, give us a listen to episode 20. So if you go back in the archives, and it was, I believe, right before we did the episode on 86 Tops, might have been right after. That's why I'm hesitating here. It was 3.5 years ago, so it's a little fuzzy. But anyways, right around when we were going to do our first podcast on 86 Tops featuring Jack Morris as our random pull, we decided, let's pull in the people behind the story and help tell the story. So if you go back in the archives, go to episode 20, you will get the lowdown of the story behind the Wax Pack book, and that's what it's called. It's called Wax Pack on the Open Road in Search of Baseball Afterlife. And the book is due to come out on April the 1st. And there have been, if you follow the Wax Pack book on Twitter, there have been some pre-sales that have been put up there. Haven't seen one recently, but keep an eye on it because you can pre-buy it, I should say. And there are some promo codes as well. So as opposed to the usual $27.50 you would pay for a book, you can get it for anywhere between $17 and $20. The author, by the way, I shouldn't just overlook him. It's Brad Balukjan. And we talked to Brad on that episode. And it's a great idea where basically you open up a pack of cards, see who's in it, and you try to track down the players that are there. Now, As you listen to that interview from 2016, Brad will say, you know, in all honesty and clarity, that they didn't just pick one pack, open it up, and go after people. They opened several packs and found one pack where they went, all right, we can actually track down these players. Because as you'll find out, even in a pack of 15 cards, there were a couple players from the 86 Tops pack who had passed away by 2016. So obviously you couldn't interview them, but you could track down family members and friends and teammates to get the story on them too. So I know one of the cards is Rance Mullenix, who is a real estate salesman, which is just awesome. And there's a lot of other great stories as well. So again, you can follow Wax Pack Book on Twitter as Brad Blukjan, as other sales come along and over the next few weeks, as you get closer to the release date of April 1st, I'm sure he'll have some more information about it. But I will say this, Topps Pursuit, because it has been 3.5 years. And I do recall when talking to Brad and say, all right, when does this book come out? He was originally looking at, you know, sometime late 2018. Well, here we are, it's, you know, almost February 2020, and it's finally becoming a reality. So I will reach out to Brad right before the book comes out. We'll make it part of his promotional tour. We'll get an update on getting the book across the finish line from concept to manuscript to actually printing and selling it. And I would highly recommend, because it's such a great concept, I would highly recommend, even without reading the book yet, to check it out. Buy it, because I think it's a really fun pursuit. And it's something that I think potentially could lead to other people doing something similar. And I think a great example of that, I forget the author's name. I could probably look it up here. Hold on, stand by. I can't believe I forgot his name, because this was a book that I used to read a lot as a teenager because it just seemed like such a far out idea. Here we go. Bob Wood, Dodger Dogs to Fenway Franks. He wrote this back in, I think, 1986. And well, it was published in 1988, but it happened in the 1985 season. Bob Wood came up with this then crazy idea, a lot of people have done it since then, of going to then all 26 major league ballparks and describing his experience, not only at the ballpark, but getting there. Like I remember in San Francisco, his car got broken into. You know, he did a report card on all the stadiums. So as a kid, you know, I'm reading this around 1990, I was just fascinated by this notion of, wow, somebody can just get in their car and over the time span of about, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, go city to city, ballpark to ballpark. How cool is that? And like I said, a lot of other people have done it since. They've done different variations of it. Some of them have tied in a charity into it. And of course, now you've got more ballparks. You've got 30 ballparks. And it may actually be cheaper to fly and rent a car in some cities than, you know, do it the way Bob did in his beat up little, you know, subcompact back in the mid 80s. But it's an interesting book because, again, at the time it was a revolutionary idea. I'm not really aware if anybody had done that kind of thing before Bob Wood, but it's a fun book to look back on, and I may even buy it. I think Amazon's got it here used for like $4. I may actually buy it because, you know, you're looking back to 1985 now. There's a lot of those stadiums that are no longer in commission. In fact, it's easier to count the stadiums that still exist than to count the ones that don't anymore. Because really, it's what? Fenway Park, Dodger Stadium, Angel Stadium, although it's changed quite a bit since then, Wrigley Field, and Kauffman Stadium, too. That one's still there. And I think that is it. I may be missing one. I'm going to beat myself up because I'm going to realize it after. Oh, Oakland. Yeah, the Coliseum. But other than those, all the other ballparks have changed. And like I said, there have been a few others that have been added since expansion in the early to mid 90s. So, you know, that is something that I know sparked a lot of people to do a similar thing. And I'm curious if Brad Blukjan's book here, The Wax Pack, actually inspires other people to, you know, within the letter of the law, go out and try to find these former players and coaches and talk to them. And we've seen it too with, you know, the vintage packs. You know, people go out and open up vintage packs of baseball cards, and, you know, you find an athlete from, you know, the 80s or the 90s to open up a pack of cards and talk about the players that are featured there. Sometimes they're teammates, sometimes they're players that they went up against. So that started out, what, about 8 or 10 years ago? And, you know, other people have kind of run with that. So I'm curious to see how the Wax Pack Book, what kind of effect it has on sports fans opening up packs of old cards, finding some of these players, and giving an update on their life status. So we really appreciate that. Also, just want to let you know that our next show on February 14th, speaking of love, we're going to be talking about Garbage Pail Kids and also Wacky Packs. Again, we're breaking format just a little bit here, and I don't want to do this too often because it is very easy to go down the non-sports rabbit hole, especially because a lot of the non-sports cards are dealing with things that were popular, you know, pop culture things from the past. It's very easy to find the cards for E.T. or Family Ties or James Bond, you know, the Moonraker cards, Star Wars, you name it. So I really don't want to go down that path too much, but by listener demand, people are intrigued how we can do something about the Garbage Pail Kids. We will be doing that in our next show, thanks to a very generous donation of Garbage Pail Kids wax packs and single cards from Brian Kilby. And also, I was able to track down, I believe it's from 1980, a wacky package of top stickers on eBay. So we're going to dive into that just a little bit. It's not baseball cards. However, it is something that was both of these items, actually, very influential in not only collecting culture, but pop culture as well. And influential enough, remember I said that retro and throwback stuff, nostalgia is all the rage these days. Well, just a few years ago, Topps brought back both Wacky Packages and Garbage Pail Kids. Now, very niche items. A lot of them you could just buy online from the Topps store. But I do recall Topps Wacky Packages in retail outlets just a few years ago. So it's still big enough and important enough for Topps to realize, hey, there's still money to be made off of this. And if I recall, too, the Garbage Pail Kids that came out a few years ago, a lot of them were centered around the 2016 presidential election and the debates and all the various candidates leading up to it. So I'd be curious if they're going to go down that path, albeit a very tricky one with the tribalism in our country these days. I wonder if they're going to be doing that over the next few months. Lastly, before we get back to the main topic of our show this week, I do want to remind people that cash donations are always accepted and appreciated via our PayPal page. That is paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. Want to send out a shout out to Micah Cartwright. Caught on to your show a few months ago, and I really enjoy it. Keep up the great work. Micah, thank you for the comments and for the donation as well. We also heard from Andrew Lathrin sending us a nice donation as well recently. So thank you, Micah, Andrew, and everybody who has made donations in the past. Now, remember, we're not asking for hundreds of dollars. If you got it, God bless you. I love you if you do it. But we are just looking for spare change. You got $2, $5, $10, $20, whatever it is. You survive the holidays. You got a little bit of disposable income. If you make that donation, it does a lot of things for us. First of all, it pays our fees to Audioboom to host the podcast. It also keeps us from basically taking the archives, the first 100 or 120 episodes of this program, and putting it behind a paywall. I could do that, but I prefer to keep it free and open to everybody. So generous donations help us do that. And also it goes to purchasing the products that we discuss on the show. So there's something that I bought. I won't tell you what it is yet, but once I get it in the mail, I think it'll be something that we touch on either on our February 28th show, or after that, there'll be March 13th. We'll dive into a special kind of rack pack. But I was able to purchase that last night off eBay because of your contributions. It was something I saw. It was finishing up its auction in just a few seconds. I dove in, swooped it up. And had we not had the cash contributions, from people such as Andrew and Mike and everybody else wouldn't have happened. So it helps make us a little more nimble in acquiring some of these cards to discuss and in many cases to pass along to young consumers as we donate the extras of cards that we have to the great people at Commons for Kids who donate common cards, both past and present cards, and for all sports, not just baseball, donate them to kids in need, kids who can't afford baseball cards, or kids who are just having a rough time. Maybe they're in a foster home, maybe they're in a hospital, a cancer center, dealing with some other major adversity. And while we're looking at baseball cards as just kind of this fun little hobby, this pastime from our childhood, it allows these kids to have a childhood, to forget about some of this nonsense that they have to deal with in their lives. So give them a follow, too, on Twitter, Commons for Kids. That's the number 4, Commons for Kids. And know that every donation you make, there's a pretty good chance that it goes from a dollar amount in your bank account or your wallet all the way into a collection of cards for kids that Commons for Kids helps distribute. So certainly a great group to do that with. Now, a great topic, a real fun topic, like I said, when I was suggested this by my friend, Coach Mike, I said, this is awesome. Yeah, absolutely. I should do this. And I took it from the Andrew Ridgely approach because, again, 90% of these multiplayer rookie cards, you have one glaringly obvious Hall of Fame or Hall of Fame worthy player and anywhere from 1 to 3 other guys that you look at nowadays and go, who is this? And chances are the only people that know about this particular player is friends and family members. And that's not a knock. That's just how it is. You know, the sands of time over the last 40, 45 years with some of these cards, you just don't even recognize who some of these players are. So what brought in the multiplayer rookie card in 1962? Well, as I said earlier, I can't find any kind of official explanation. And good luck trying to find somebody who was working at Topps in the early 1960s, because if they're still alive, they're probably around 90 years old, which would make for fascinating storytelling, but maybe even they don't know, you know, what went into the decision-making process. But what I can figure is it comes down to expansion. And as we've discussed when looking at the sets from 1961, 62, and 69, and 77, expansion threw a major monkey wrench into the Topps planning and production. The 77 set was a challenge because that was also after the first winter of free agency. So you had well over 100 players wearing a different ball cap in the 1977 season, whether they were picked up by the Blue Jays or Mariners in the expansion draft, or they were signing contracts with new teams like Reggie Jackson or Don Baylor, for example. You had a lot of player movement. But it was a real conundrum for Topps in the early 60s, because once they killed off Bowman and once they were able to get every player under contract to appear on their cards, in the late 1950s, you had a set number of cards that you could have. Basically, you knew that you had a 25-man roster. You had 16 teams. So at the max, you know, maybe if you include league leaders, or maybe if you're including World Series recap cards or manager cards, you pretty much had a good idea of how big your set was going to be. Well, along comes expansion, first in 1961 with the Angels and the second Washington Senators, that coupled with the movement of the original Senators to Minnesota, that expands the size of the set. And with 1962 coming around, now you've got the Mets, you've got the Colt 45s, all of a sudden, you've got 100 new players in Major League Baseball. Now, not all rookies, but the player pool has gone from, roughly 600 to bulging a little bit, closer to 700. And especially with expansion teams, and this still carries on today, not just in baseball, but other sports as well, although most recent expansions, and I'm thinking the NHL in particular, has been slanted to make the team more successful sooner than your traditional expansion team story. Still, you're pulling together basically a lot of veteran cast-offs from other teams and a lot of borderline guys, the guys that we like to call 4As, who are pretty good in the minor leagues, but just can't cut it in the majors. Maybe they can't hit the breaking ball. Maybe they're a little slow on the base paths. Maybe they've got a terrible slider that just doesn't break and people are clouding it 400 feet the other way. Whatever the reason is, all four of these teams had this mix of older guys that teams didn't want anymore, and younger guys that just didn't fit into the plans of the established teams. So going into the 1962 production line, I think Topps was looking at this going, hey, we can't have this massive set of cards, especially when four of the teams are going to feature a lot of players that not a lot of people care about. Now, there are some exceptions. You know, the Mets had Gil Hodges and eventually Yogi Berra and, you know, Duke Snyder. You know, there were some old-time favorites that ended up landing with these teams over time. But you look at the rosters of those first Senators, Angels, Colt 45s, and Mets teams, not a whole lot of star power. And that's also why they were just absolutely morbid when they hit the field. Of course, the Mets setting the modern day record for losses in a season with 120 in a 162 game schedule. So Topps was really stuck here going, okay, we've got all of these players flooding the market here, and expansion was going to be the thing. Major League Baseball was planning on doing it again in the early 70s. Instead, though, with the Athletics moving from Kansas City to Oakland so abruptly, and because of some astute politicians, they were able to move the expansion up to 1969. They were going to have to deal with this influx of players, some good young people, but mostly veteran players, and they just didn't want to make the set this colossal beast of cards. And that's something that they would eventually have to do in the late 70s. But in the early 60s, they didn't want to do this. And keep in mind, too, Topps at the time was still producing sets in several series. And one of the main problems with that line of production was if you had a 6 or a 7 series set, as the summer went on, and as kids got back to school and football starts getting underway, those later series, the 5s, 6s, and 7s, they were purchased less by wholesalers because the retail outlets couldn't move them. The customers had moved on to other things in their lives. Baseball season was, you know, in the rearview mirror, especially with the playoff series the way that it was done back then. You didn't have a divisional series until 1969. So if you lived in a market where your home team was not a contender, you know, chances are you rode off baseball by July. You were turning your focus, you know, like I said, to upcoming school or professional football, or depending on where you lived, college football. And, you know, you had a lot of leftover product sitting in the warehouses. And that's why those higher number series cards are worth so much more, because they were short printed. There were fewer of them made. There were fewer of them that went out. Fewer of them were sold. So there's a premium to it. So, you know, Topps didn't want to make this 800 card set have, you know, 8 series or 9 series when you knew that the sales were going to dip after pretty much the All-Star game year in and year out. So I think they came to this conclusion and went, well, why don't we just take several players and just put them on a card? And that's what started off in 1962, what was known as the Rookie Parade. That's what they called it. And they would group these players in a couple of different ways. One was through the team that they played for, and then another was with positions. And there was really no rhyme or reason behind this. You know, one card would have Cubs rookies, and you'd have 4 or 5 guys on there, and another card would have rookie infielders, rookie outfielders, and they would just pile on a bunch of players there. So, like I said, there was really no rhyme or reason behind this, and I think that leads to the notion that this was something that they did simply to just reduce the capacity or reduce the amount of cards that they had to produce, instead of devoting a single card to a player who may or may not make it. They decided to lump all these players together, one, to showcase some of the players of the expansion teams, but also, again, just to keep the number of cards that they had to print down to a reasonable number. So in 1962, you've got individual rookie cards like Gaylord Perry and Lou Brock, players who were able to distinguish themselves early enough to where they merited their own card. But then you had the rookie parade, and one great example of the rookie parade card is catchers, where the most notable name on this catcher card is Bob Uecker. Now, Bob Uecker is beloved in Milwaukee, beloved as an actor, as a broadcaster, as a unique personality to say it. Certainly his baseball career wasn't numbers alone, something to write home about. But, you know, Bob Uecker is the most recognizable name on this card, along with Doug Camilli of the Dodgers, Don Pavlicek of the Reds, Doc Edwards of the Indians, and Ken Retzer of the Senators. So you had this pile of borderline players here, and that was just the best way that Topps could, you know, combine all of the, you know, the roster guys that were either, you know, new to baseball or who were just kind of fringe players here without blowing up the entire size of the set. So in 1962, you had the rookie parade. Like I said, really the most notable name from a lot of those cards is Bob Uecker. As you look through the 1962 set, there's, you know, nothing that really stands out there. Now, that would change, however, come 1963, as the rookie cards featured a couple of key young stars, most notably Pete Rose, along with Willie Stargell. Now, Pete Rose's card, which is not of teams, it is just of rookie stars, is what it's called, features Rose along with Pedro Gonzalez of the Yankees, Ken McMullen of the Dodgers, and Al Weiss, then with the White Sox. Now, another interesting quirk about the rookie cards in 1963 is sometimes they have the subheading of 1962 rookie stars. So even though it was a 63 set, the 1962 banner throws a lot of people for a loop. Now, as I mentioned, the other big 1963 rookie card, Willie Stargell, who is not paired up with, but grouped together with Brock Davis of the Colt 45s, Jim Gosger of the Red Sox, and John Herrnstein of the Phillies. So that those are two great examples of bona fide star players who are paired up with some lesser known, no offense, but lesser known players on those cards. Now, moving on to 1964, Topps would get away from the four-player presentation and actually provide a little bit of breathing room for some of their rookie cards. So Tommy John had his rookie card. He was paired up with Bob Chance on a card that is showcasing rookie stars for the Indians in 1964. Jesus Alou, a semi-star, I would say, paired up with Ron Herbill of the San Francisco Giants on that card. Also in 1964, you've got Phil Niekro paired up with Phil Roof, a catcher for the Braves, although Nuxie's certainly the bigger of the two on that particular card there. And you also had there in 1964 the first of three rookie cards for Lou Piniella. It's funny, I just finished reading Lou Piniella's autobiography, and if you read up about his path to Major League Baseball and the very long and winding road he took through the minor leagues, it's understandable why not only he bounced around from team to team and organization to organization, I think he was traded five times or six times before he settled in with the Seattle Pilots in 1969. Actually, before he settled in with the Kansas City Royals, I should say. He was part of the Pilots' spring training, but then he got traded to the Royals right at the beginning of the 1969 season. That's where things finally settled down for him. Well, 1964, Piniella was part of the Senators organization, and he's paired up with catcher Mike Brumley. Now, those are some of the notable 1964 cards. If we move on to 1965, without a doubt, the biggest one is Steve Carlton, who was a prospect of the St. Louis Cardinals. He is paired up with Fritz Ackley. Yes, we've got Steve Carlton and the Fritz as part of a dynamic duo of rookie stars in 1965. Also, speaking of dynamic duo for Houston, now this is when the Colt 45s are changing their name to the Astros. So on a card that just says Houston rookie stars, you've got Uber prospect and Houston area native Joe Morgan paired up with Sonny Jackson, an infielder slash outfielder utility man who was so terrible at his job Later on, when he was playing for the Atlanta Braves, some yokel put up wanted posters accusing Jackson of impersonating a major league ball player. Also on the 1965 rookie parade, if you will, even though they weren't called rookie parades back then, you had Tony Perez sharing his rookie card with Kevin Collins of the Mets and Dave Ricketts of the Cardinals. Now, this one was not for a team. It was just National League, 1965 rookie stars. Phil Niekro would have a second rookie card as he had to share a card alongside Clay Carroll, another pitcher then with the Milwaukee Braves. And you had a four-player rookie card for the Kansas City Athletics. Of course, then they were really stocking up on minor league talent. So the Topps Company making a very wise move here to feature four players, including Jim Catfish Hunter and Johnny Blue Moon Odom. Also of note on this rookie card, Skip Lockwood and Renee Latchman. Latchman, of course, a coach and manager for a very long time after his playing career. Now, if we fast forward to 1966... there aren't as many egregious mispairings of rookies as we've seen in previous sets. However, the most notable one features rookie stars for the Dodgers, Don Sutton, who would be a 300-game winning Hall of Fame pitcher, paired up with pitcher Bill Singer, who was a pretty decent pitcher, but who dealt with arm injuries and whose career was done by the late 1970s. And then, of course, really got his career done by saying some rather unfortunate things in the press later on. Now, you would also have some notable names such as George Scott appearing on a 1966 rookie card, as well as Darryl Knowles and Andy Etchebarren and his massive unibrow on one particular card. But other than the Don Sutton card, nothing really standing out in terms of the dynamic duos. Now, that would be made up for in 1967, as Tom Terrific, Tom Seaver, was paired up with Bill Dennehy. Yes, your 1967 Mets rookie stars. Everyone remembers Nolan Ryan and Jerry Kuzman, but Bill Dennehy and his rookie card, able to ride the coattails of Tom Seaver for many, many, many years now. From the mound to the plate, another standout rookie, and this one wasn't a team rookie card, but an American League rookie stars card, Rod Carew, along with Hank Allen, an outfielder for the Washington Senators. That is definitely a mismatch. Rod Carew, the almighty hit king in the American League, and Mr. Howard, that's pretty much one of the biggest lopsided goof-ups that Topps was able to pair together on one particular card. Now, in 1968, everyone remembers the Ryan and Kuzman card, but there was another notable, interesting pairing of young rookie stars for the Cincinnati Reds organization. Ron Tompkins, a pitcher who started out with the Athletics, paired alongside some young stud catcher wearing his hat backwards, pictured at Tampa's Al Lopez Field. That was the spring training home of the Cincinnati Reds. Yes, one Johnny Bench. Talk about an anchor behind a plate for so many seasons, a key cog in the big red machine of the 1970s, and another very lopsided rookie pairing in a Topps baseball card history. You also had Hal McRae and Bill Henry on a Reds rookie card. On a National League rookie star card, you had Larry Heisel and Mike Lum. And while Lum had a decent little career, Heisel was just a hitting machine and had a great career as a coach. And then you have card number 2 of 3 in the Lou Piniella files, as he was with the Indians organization then, paired up with Richie Sheinblum in his 2nd of 3 rookie cards. Then moving on to 1969, Topps was very, very, very aware of how big of a star Reggie Jackson would be, so they wisely gave him his own card, as that is one of the key cards in that set. But some other players, not so fortunate. And again, expansion playing a big part in how some of these cards were divvied up. I mentioned earlier in the show, Greg Nettles, along with Danny Morris. Raleigh Fingers has a rookie card as well, as he shares it with other American leaguers, Bob Floyd of the Orioles and Larry Burkhart of the Indians. But if you look through a lot of the multiplayer rookie cards in 1969, you'll see that a lot of them are featuring rookie stars, quote-unquote stars. We've got to be very flexible with that word. But a lot of rookie players for mainly the expansion team. So again, those borderline guys that you probably don't know a whole lot about are featured on these cards, including Lou Piniella in rookie card 3 of 3, this with the Seattle Pilots. And as I mentioned, he wasn't with the Pilots too long. He would get snapped up by the Royals. But he's paired up with infielder Marv Staley, who also had a rookie card back in 1966. Now, as you go into the 70s, things would settle down a little bit. You didn't have the 3 and 4 card players in 1970 and 71, Topps ultimately going with the dual players. And you would have some notable players such as Thurman Munson and Vida Blue in the 1970 set. And, a couple other standouts in 71 as well. I think Bobby Valentine was one of them. But it really wasn't until 1972 that Topps not only went back to the multiplayer, the 3 and 4 arrangements, 3 and 4 player arrangements on their cards. In most cases, there were still some 2-player arrangements in the 72 set, but they would go back to 3 and 4 for the most part. And that is where we get into some of the selected cards from my own personal collection and some great stories about the Andrew Ridgelys, if you will, of some cards from the 1970s and going up into the early 1980s. So we'll start from my collection, one of the legendary cards from the 1972 set, the Carlton Fisk rookie card. Now, he's paired up along with 2 other Red Sox prospects. And if you know the history of the Boston Red Sox, they were really digging into some prospects in the late 60s and early 70s. Yes, they had the miracle run in 1967, getting to Game 7 of the World Series against the Cardinals. But other than the miracle run in 67, there were some lean years in Boston Red Sox history throughout the 1960s. Well, the good thing is, of course, with the amateur draft instituted in 1965, if you were bad, you had a good chance of getting some good players. And the Red Sox scouting crew had a field day pulling in youngsters such as Carlton Fisk. And also featured on the rookie card is Cecil Cooper. And Cooper would have a bigger starring role in the success of the Milwaukee Brewers in the late 70s and early 80s. But certainly Cooper's career, nothing to sneeze at. Not quite Carlton Fisk level, much like Kuzmin to Ryan, but certainly a notable and honorable career. But what about the third guy on the card? Mike Garmin, who was a pitcher in the Red Sox organization, originally from Caldwell, Idaho. And there's a lot of amazing stories about Mike Garmin, although it wouldn't come to light until many, many years later. As Garmin was selected in the 1967 draft, he was actually the 3rd overall selection. And he was signing with the Red Sox as soon as he graduated from high school, goes up into the Red Sox minor league system, and finally makes his major league debut at the end of the 1969 season as a September call-up. Now, he would also appear with the Red Sox as a September call-up in the 71 and 72 seasons, and in 73, he would see some regular time with the Red Sox as a member of the bullpen. However, as the Red Sox were growing into a pretty formidable team in the mid to late 70s, they decided to part ways with him. Finally, following the 73 season, he's traded to the St. Louis Cardinals alongside John Curtis and Lynn McLaughlin for Reggie Cleveland, Diego Segui, and Terry Hughes. Now, Hughes, remember that name, we'll be talking about him in just a little bit. Now, it was a nice release for Garmin. He had a pretty solid year in 1974 with a 7-2 record. And even though his record dropped a little bit in 1975, he still had a pretty formidable season as his ERA dropped, and that's a good drop, to 2.39. And he picked up 10 saves in that season as well. Now, he was later traded to the Chicago Cubs for a player to be named later. That would turn out to be Don Kessinger. And he was traded to the Dodgers. In fact, it was January 11th, 1977. Garmin and Rick Monday, who was in a contract squabble with the Cubs, go out to the Dodgers for Jeff Albert, Ivan De Jesus, who would prove to be a key part of the Cubs' story in the 1980s when he was later traded for Ryan Sandberg, and Bill Buckner. Now, why are we so impressed with the Mike Garmin and Company for Bill Buckner and Company trade? Well, as Garmin would tell our friends at the Society for American Baseball Research, in particular author Bill Nolan, Garmin and Buckner found out they were traded for one another while they were out hunting along with one another. That's right. They were hunting pheasants on Garmin's farm in Idaho when they got the phone call and found out that they were traded for one another. So talk about the ultimate small world. Here are these two players being traded for one another, and they're both discovering it, of all places, when they're out hunting pheasants. Now, this move would prove to be extremely beneficial for Garmin, as he was a member of the two-time National League pennant-winning LA Dodgers, who both times lost to the Yankees in the World Series in 77 and 78. After the 78 season, he would be traded to the Expos for Jerry Hannes and Larry Landreth, and he failed to make the team in the spring of 1979. Tried to keep his career going with deals with the Pirates and Indians, but wasn't able to do that. He actually retired. Now, he would go on to run the family farm in Idaho for several years alongside his brother Steven, who was part of the Giants organization for a couple years. And then Mike Garmin would go on to be an insurance salesman with Farmers Insurance. And who was one of his clients? You guessed it, Bill Buckner. So it's amazing how the paths cross over time, as Buckner and Garmin not just traded for one another, but actually doing business with one another. Now, from 1972, we'll move on to 1974. Remember I said Terry Hughes? Remember that name? Well, we're going to talk about him now, because Hughes is on a four-player rookie infielder card, along with Frank White, Andy Thornton, and John Knox. Now, White and Thornton are the two bigger stars. Certainly not superstars, but they had very good careers, lengthy careers. But what about Terry Hughes? He was a much ballyhooed prospect who, unfortunately, just didn't pan out. Hughes was from Spartanburg, South Carolina, heavily scouted not only as a baseball player, but as a basketball player as well. And the Cubs selected him second overall in the 1967 draft. So here you have Hughes at number two, you had Garmin at number three. Both of these guys would be traded for one another later on in time. Now, as Hughes is moving up through the Cubs organization, he had a couple of things working against him. First of all, Leo Durocher, the manager of the Cubs, not very friendly to rookies and prospects. He liked grizzled veterans. So the Cubs moved him to St. Louis, and that turned out to be very beneficial for Hughes, since the Cubs, he had to basically play behind Ron Santo. And even though Santo's career was starting to wind down in the early 70s, it was very hard to break through the lineup when Santo wanted to be out in the field every day. So the Cubs really didn't want him back. They basically just let him walk, and the Cardinals would purchase his contract right before the 1973 season. And this is where he really became one of those 4A guys. Spent most of the season in AAA, had a cup of coffee with the Cardinals in 73. Topps taking a chance with him puts him up there on a card, and unfortunately for him, didn't really work out afterwards. As I mentioned, the Cardinals trading him to the Red Sox in that trade that the Cardinals sent Reggie Cleveland and Diego Segui to Boston for Lynn McLaughlin, John Curtis, and Mike Garmin. And he only appeared in 41 games for the Red Sox, basically as a defensive replacement. And his career never really went any further after that. All of the 1975 season, he was with the Pawtucket Red Sox, the AAA farm club for the Red Sox. And then he got released by the Red Sox, went on to rejoin the Cardinals in the 1976 season, but was never to see the major leagues again, as he spent most of his career in AAA. Now, afterwards, he said that he didn't regret how his career turned out, even though he was a top prospect, like I said, a second overall pick here. Just didn't pan out. And again, thanks to some details with Rory Costello of the Society for American Baseball Research, Hughes was able to share about how his brief time in the major leagues, he really enjoyed his time with Boston, as brief as it was. It was a classy organization as opposed to the Cubs. A lot of people ripping on the Cubs back then. And ever since he retired, he was a PE coach and also a baseball coach at Boiling Springs Rainbow Lake Middle School. He retired from teaching about 10 years ago, but continued to be an active coach on the baseball side shortly thereafter. Now on to the 1975 Topps catcher-outfielder card, featuring Gary Carter, the Hall of Fame catcher, and three other guys you probably don't know too much about. Well, we decided to go with Disco Danny Meyer, an outfielder and, of course, a first baseman, as his career would turn into. First with the Detroit Tigers, but he was an original member of the Seattle Mariners. Now let's talk about Disco Danny's rise to the major leagues. First of all, a native of Hamilton, Ohio, he attended the University of Arizona and also Santa Ana College, drafted by the Detroit Tigers in the 1972 draft. He makes his major league debut with the Tigers late in 1974 after a very successful season in Evansville at AAA. And in 75, he plays his first full season at the major league level, playing in left field and also first base. And at the end of the 75 season, he batted .236, had 111 hits, 8 home runs, 47 RBI. And a pretty impressive record for a 122-game season. He was a very pleasant addition to the Tigers, who, of course, were knee-deep in a rebuild at that time. Now, because they were knee-deep, the Tigers had some much more impressive prospects coming up at both the outfield and first base position. So they eventually, even though they were able to utilize him as a designated hitter through much of 1976, basically decided to move on from him. They just had some better prospects, and they needed to expose some players in the expansion draft. So ninth overall, Meyer goes to Seattle. He's playing first base for the Mariners, and like many borderline quasi-star players, and this isn't just in baseball, this is in other sports, once you get some regular playing time, you take off. And that's what Dan Meyer did. In 1977, he batted .273, 24 doubles, 159 hits, 22 home runs, and 90 RBI in 159 games played. He also led the American League with 159 defensive games at first base. It turned out he fit right into the Mariners' expansion year plans, which is basically load up on bats in the rather hitter-friendly kingdom. It was just a lack of pitching that did the Mariners in for many years. Now, Meyer would star with the Mariners throughout their first five seasons, and that is where he got the nickname of Disco Danny. And it's because every time he went up to bat, he would just kind of do this strange gyration with his body. He would try to, you know, loosen up his muscles and, you know, crack a few bones, you know, in his spine by kind of wiggling his neck and shimmying his shoulders. And the Mariners just really, you know, laughed at this and gave him that nickname of Disco Danny. Now, after the 1981 season, the Mariners traded Meyer to the Oakland A's in exchange for a young pitcher named Rich Borde. His numbers went down, however, batting .240 with 92 hits and 8 home runs. Of course, Oakland, a little less of a hitter-friendly park, definitely more pitcher-friendly. And he was shuffled around from first base and right field and left field, also utilized as a designated hitter. Now, his major league career started winding down in 1984. He started the season with the Tacoma Tigers in AAA. And despite resigning with the A's in 1985, he went hitless in 12 at-bats. He was released by the team in May. And for the remainder of the season, he played in AAA Nashville, which at the time was a minor league affiliate for the Tigers. Now, he would go on to play in the Mexican League, also the Independent California League, and the Senior Professional Baseball Association, a member of the Bradenton Explorers. Well, I can do a show about the Senior Professional Baseball League. That's an interesting league in and of itself, why it worked and why it didn't work. Now, after his playing days, Meyer would work for AT&T as an account representative. And eventually, as AT&T was consolidating their business operations, instead of moving, he decided to stay in California, worked all sorts of odd jobs, and eventually worked as a hitting coach, a private hitting coach in California for several years. So that's the Disco Danny Meyer story, the Andrew Ridgely, if you will, of the 1975 Topps card with Gary Carter. Let's move on to 1977. We've got the Hawk, Andre Dawson, sharing a rookie's outfielder card along with John Scott, who was the starting left fielder for the Blue Jays when they started, and Denny Walling, who had a pretty decent career with Oakland and later Houston in the 1980s. But what about Gene Richards? You know, Gene Richards was actually a pretty decent player. but I don't think got a lot of credit that he was due because he played much of his career in San Diego, which in the late 1970s was just a black hole in baseball. Richards was born in Monticello, South Carolina, attended South Carolina State University. He was the first overall selection in the 1975 Major League Draft by the Padres. A lefty, stood 6 feet tall, weighed 175 pounds, very speedy player. In fact, he set the then modern-day MLB record for rookies with 56 stolen bases during a season. That was breaking a record that was previously set in 1910 and matched in 1966. The player who matched the record that was originally set by Raleigh Zelder, Sonny Jackson, who we were talking about earlier, pairing up his Andrew Ridgely rookie card with Joe Morgan of the Houston Colt 45s. Now, in his rookie season, this is in 1977, he finished the season with a .290 batting average and actually finished third in the voting for the National League Rookie of the Year Award. And that's pretty impressive, especially since the guy who won the National League Rookie of the Year Award in 1977 was his card mate, Andre Dawson of the Montreal Expos. Now, as his career continued with the Padres through the 1983 season, and even though he was a demon on the base paths and had a pretty good batting average, the Padres were starting to move in some youngsters, including somebody named Tony Gwynn, who was playing the outfield. He didn't have a DH in the National League, so Gene Richards was on the move, as he would get moved to the San Francisco Giants in the 1984 season. And this very interesting trivial note here, speaking of Tony Gwynn, Gene Richards had a lot of records that were broken by Tony Gwynn, including a single season record for hits by a Padre, career records for triples and steals by a Padre, and he is the only other player in Padres history other than Tony Gwynn to wear the number 19, which he wore during the 1978 season. So while you're friends with that trivial information there, Gene Richards and Tony Gwynn, the only number 19s in Padre history. So if you ever want to know who else, you know, talk about Andrew Ridgely's yeah, great number 19s in San Diego Padres history, Tony Gwynn and Gene Richards there. Now, after he retired as a player in 1984, again with the San Francisco Giants, he spent two decades as a coach, a roving instructor, and a manager in minor league baseball. He was with the Angels, the Dodgers, and the Mets system, was also a scout for the Seattle Mariners, and became a baseball instructor for all levels of youth baseball in Reno, Nevada. Last but certainly not least, we've got Dave Henderson here. And Dave Henderson, with the 1982 Topps card, is paired up with other Seattle Mariners future stars Reggie Walton and Dave Edler. We decided to go with Dave Edler. And Dave Edler's got a very interesting story here, not necessarily for what he did on the ball field, but for what he did after, as is often the case with a lot of these players here. Now, Dave Edler was born in Sioux City, Iowa, and he is best known for what he did afterwards, although let's start off with his playing career, as he played baseball for the Washington State Cougars in the late 1970s. So naturally, the Mariners swoop in and make him part of their organization, where he played third base from 1980 to 1983. Really nothing spectacular stats-wise. In fact, for a career that lasted about 2.5 seasons from start to finish, his last major league game was in June of 83. He had a .216 career batting average, 6 home runs, 36 RBI. Definitely not really power numbers for a power position. The hot corner at third base, of course, the Mariners also had Lenny Randle, who I think got more starts than Edler ever did. But what's interesting is after Edler's playing days, he got into politics. He was a member of the Yakima, Washington City Council from 2003 and the ceremonial mayor of Yakima, Washington from 2006 to 2010. So while Dave Henderson certainly had a much more notable career, even Reggie Walton had some more highs than lows, Dave Edler, somewhat forgettable third baseman for the Mariners in their early years, but a politician for Yakima, first as a city council member and then the honorary mayor of Yakima for 4 years afterwards. Now, it's rather appropriate we finish up with 1982 because 1982 was the year that Topps pulled the plug on these multiplayer rookie cards. And why did they do that? Well, remember 1982, the rookie card rage was going on. That was the whole new niche to baseball cards. Now with Fleer and Donruss joining Topps in the competition, all the companies try to edge each other out by having the hot rookies in their base sets before anyone else did. Now this would often lead to more misses than hits, but every now and then you had a player who was so obviously going to be a star player, you had to include him in the base set. Well, in 1982, both Fleer and Donruss had an individual rookie card for the uber prospect of the Baltimore Orioles, Cal Ripken Jr. Topps did not. They had him as part of a three-player rookie card of Orioles future stars, and that didn't make them look too good. Topps had to, in 1982, in their newly separate traded set, the 81 traded set was kind of an extension of the base set. Well, the traded set in 1982 features Ripken with his own rookie card, but Topps learned its lesson. Yes, you could always have the traded set for those rookies that maybe you missed out on in the base set, or you're hanging on to a key rookie to help sell that set. I think that was the case with Ken Griffey Jr. in 1989. But with rookies being the rage, and it starts with guys like Ricky Henderson, but also even lesser known phenoms, such as Joe Charbonneau with the Indians or Ron Kittle with the White Sox, Topps decided to put all of their resources into single player rookie cards. So that's why in 1983, the rookie cards of players such as Tony Gwynn and Ryan Sandberg and Wade Boggs, and in 84 you had Don Mattingly, Roger Clemens after that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they were featured on those single cards. Now, Topps would go back to the multiplayer cards in 1992. Well, why would they do that, especially when they got embarrassed by some of these single, or not single, but by some of the other rookie cards that had, a bona fide star player on there having to share space with players that most people didn't know about or even care about? Well, again, it comes down to expansion, and not just of Major League Baseball teams, but an expansion of the sets as well, with baseball cards at an all-time high swelling in size in the early 1990s. And again, 50 additional players with the introduction of the Marlins and Rockies in 1993, Topps very wisely said, okay, we're not going to produce an 850-card set or a 900-card set like Scorer is doing. You got to keep things at a manageable size here. So they kept the 792-card base set by combining a lot of these rookie players. One of the best examples of the multiplayer rookie cards in 1992, Chipper Jones, sharing his card with Will Cordero, Manny Alexander, and Alex Arias. Now, much like Lou Piniella, Chipper Jones had to have a second rookie card as he appeared in the 1993 set, also sharing space with three other players. And you would think, you know, Chipper was a pretty notable prospect. Like, I recall people were talking about him. In fact, he had an Upper Deck prospect card in 1991. So it wasn't like Chipper Jones was just this guy that came out of nowhere. Yet for whatever reason, Topps decided to print up another multiplayer card in 1993 with Chipper Jones. At the very least, he was able to carry the weight of all the other players that were on that card. Now, also of note from the 93 set, you had the great Mike Piazza sharing a top prospects catcher's card along with Carlos Delgado. While Delgado's career was cut short because of injuries, he had a very productive career, and I remember him just crushing the ball out of Dunedin Stadium back in the early 90s. But those two guys had to share a rookie card with Donnie Leshnock and Brooke Fordyce. And then it would continue in 1994, of course, the big rookie card in that set, Derek Jeter, sharing a 1994 prospects card with Brandon Wilson, Mike Neal, and Orlando Miller. And eventually, Topps would peel away. They would have rookie sets, and, you know, the traded set became traded and rookies, so they were able to really jump on the rookie craze in the mid-90s that way. But again, because of expansion of Major League Baseball and not wanting to expand the set while still capitalizing on big rookie players, I think Topps felt they had to go back to the multiplayer cards, even though you had guys like Chipper Jones and Mike Piazza sharing rookie cards with other guys, and Derek Jeter, most notably, that you may not know much about the other players. But I know, especially in the 92 and 93 sets, the cards were balanced out by some of the individual rookie cards, such as Manny Ramirez in 1992. You also had Pedro Martinez in the early sets there. And also you had the Derek Jeter top prospect card in 1993, the solo card that is really the moneymaker now, especially since he just got inducted into the Hall of Famer. It was announced he will be inducted this upcoming summer. So some interesting reasons why Topps went through this rigmarole, why they went back and forth between multiplayer cards, back to single player cards, back to multiplayer cards here. And while, again, I haven't found an official description why they did it, the best I can come up with is just looking at the timing. The reluctance of Topps to expand the size of the sets, or in the case of the 1960s, expanding for an extra series of cards when they had trouble selling the high number series back then, and just not wanting to bloviate the set, giving up a lot of precious cardboard space to players who may or may not make it in the major leagues. And by doing that, that forced the Andrew Ridgely of cards. Numerous examples that we went through of a star card, or a star player, I should say, sharing a card with players that are, let's just say, common card players, although, as we've discussed, not necessarily common people in their lives. Well, that'll do it for this episode of Wax Ecstatic. Again, we'll be back on Friday, February the 14th, breaking format a little bit, talking Garbage Pail Kids and Topps Wacky Packages. So make sure you join us along Audio Boom and all of our channels, including Apple Podcasts, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify. Don't forget to rate and review our podcast. And also, please, if you have a few extra bucks, send us a donation at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Help give back to the program so we can give back to you in the future. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. You've been listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.